What I was surprised at was like how the conversation about standardization was a challenge, and that was like a real learning process for me. Was like, how do you engage people to change as adults, both and physicians? I think, and I'm still trying to figure that one out. Like, I can't quite figure out how do you engage people to change, and how do you get teach an old dog new tricks? And that's been way more challenging than actually changing one layer versus two layer for just myself. Is how do you engage people who are doing the thousands and thousands of C-sections around the country to buy into something like this?
Evidence-based and med-ed enthusiasts, and welcome to the OBG Core Exchange, a podcast produced by the OBG Project. We all know that learning and teaching in medicine operates largely on an apprenticeship model, where we see one, do one, teach one, and it leads to highly variable experiences. It can be difficult to navigate, especially in the research realm. So join us as your hosts, Ashley Comfort and Nancy Cheshire, bring in guest researchers to discuss their experiences and highlight multiple perspectives from the time of them as medical students, residents, fellows, or other emerging investigators alongside to learn what has worked best for them. Okay, so today we are very, very excited. We have two fabulous MFMs with us. So if you'd like to introduce us yourselves, and Jeff, we'll have you start off first.
My name is Jeff Sperling. I'm a maternal fetal medicine physician at Kaiser Permanente in the Central Valley of California. I've been in practice for about 2.5 years. And I went to fellowship at UC San Francisco and residency at Brown, where I met Josh.
Great, perfect segue. Thank you. So Josh, you're up next.
Sure. My name is Josh Dahlke. I'm also maternal fetal medicine. I practice in the great state of Nebraska at Methodist Women's Hospital in Omaha. I've been practicing, I finished fellowship in 2014, so going on 8 years now. And I did my fellowship at Brown, as Jeff said, and I did my residency at the Naval Hospital in San Diego.
Great. Well, first off, I know that Jeff had alluded to this, but can you tell us a little bit about kind of what drew you to high risk obstetrics and what brought you to the field?
I think it's the perfect field in medicine. Obstetrics is a wonderful time period and time frame in someone's life, first of all, and to be able to be a part of that is truly a privilege, and to then parlay that into dealing with the complications and helping patients and loved ones navigate through those issues it's by far to me the most rewarding experience on a daily basis. So those are the primary reasons I went into it.
I went to OBGYN to be a GYN oncologist. I thought I wanted to be in the OR for like 8 hours a day and saving people's lives and curing cancer. And I got there and I just, I hated being in the operating room that long. And I also, it was, that was part of it, but also I just found that I was like attracted to the people that were working in maternal fetal medicine. Like the faculty and the fellows were just my kind of people. And I've never met a maternal fetal medicine doctor that doesn't like their job, you know? And I think you can age through your career really nicely and gracefully. And on top of all the other things that Josh said, which is it's the most rewarding work on the planet. And I love taking care of patients. I think a significant portion of our job is interfacing with colleagues and multidisciplinary care. And I think we're pushing the field forward both clinically, but like from a social perspective as well. And so I really love doing obstetrics, period. Whether that's high risk or low risk, I just enjoy taking care of women during pregnancy.
My only memory of Jeff in residency was he always seemed like an MFM. So if he's telling you this GYN oncology stuff, I kind of doubt it, because he was, as soon as he got a little taste of MFM, he was all in.
Yeah.
It seems to be a prerequisite for wanting to be an MFM. You have to go through this path where you think you want to be a GYN oncologist, and then you segue into MFM. And I guess, how did you two end up working together? Like, who found who?
I think it happened pretty organically, didn't it, Jeffrey?
Yeah.
I think you were maybe a second year resident when I started, and I remember you on your MFM rotation, and just, this is a common theme, I think, from your other podcasts, is you kind of gravitate toward different mentors, and certainly at Brown, the mentor that we both had was Dwight Rouse, and so just putting all of our heads together to try to come up with different projects was something very satisfying during my time at Fellowship, for sure. And whenever you get a chance to have a resident who's equally interested and curious, you kind of want to latch onto those people. And Jeff was certainly that person in residency.
But those meetings with Dwight must have been very solemn.
Yeah, no. No. Very, very boring. Very just cut to the chase kind of things. Yeah, no.
He would cut you off in the middle of a meeting. You'd be like talking and he'd be like, that's enough. We're done. You got to go. And that was it. And you just, you knew that was the end of the meeting. And you'd be like, that was the time I got with him and I'm going to savor that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And he love the guy. I mean, I would have gravitated to him as well. Had I had the opportunity early in my career.
I remember this time.
I remember we were talking about different the three indications for cerclage in an evidence-based fashion in our obstetric triage. In like a 5-minute lecture, I had just was so confused about why we do cerclages and who gets them. And it was made even more confusing by the non-indicated cerclages I had done to date. And you know, Josh just laid it out.
Residency.
Exactly. And he laid it out crystal clear. And he goes, these are the three reasons. And it was like a 5-minute impromptu lecture. And I just got it. And I remember exactly where we're standing and having the conversation. And it's sort of those moments, I think, both in one's training, but also when you develop relationships where you go, that person is thinking how I need to think.
I think that you had said something earlier before we started to record that I would love to hear a little bit more about. You said that you were talking about your research philosophy and how that helped you navigate. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because it sounds very relatable in terms of looking to see what you can actually just get done during residency while working 60 to 80 hours a week, at least what we're logging.
I'm a big fan of doing what's doable in residency and then getting a little bit more creative in fellowship, but really like choosing projects that are going to have an end and that you have support from your mentor for. Because I think when you start driving completely on your own without support of a senior researcher, I think you may flounder and that can be a struggle. But my course through research and fellowship, which is where I did more stuff, was kind of just like, let's explore this. Cause I think it's a time where you can be a little bit more creative, to the point where I was like thinking about doing optic nerve sheath diameter ultrasounds in patients with preeclampsia. And you go, wow, how did you find that? But my brain was just exploring anywhere I could possibly go. And I think that is a great way of approaching science and medicine and clinical research questions, is with just like ultimate inquiry. I think when you start focusing on publications and where you're going to be in your career, you like lose sight of what really is exciting about it, which is just, you know, using it as a creative outlet.
The OBG Resident Core is a website designed for residents by residents and former residents. Everything we wish we had in our hands and brains during residency. Mobile friendly, easily searchable, and quick reads. Catch up between patients or meetings with your chief resident. The OBG Resident Core is free for all residents and includes an OBG First subscription. To sign up for the core, visit www.obgconnect.com/core, CORE, to sign up today.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's just so remarkable is when you really think about what we do in obstetrics, and I'm sure also in gynecology, and you query the basis for what we do, it tends to crumble so quickly. Not for everything, but so there's always a question that can get answered in a new way, new techniques, new ways of formulating the questions.
I think the curiosity part of it is critical too. I know some of that is certain environments in residency, and different residencies are better or worse at this, but to foster the environment where a resident can ask, why do we do it this way? Why aren't we doing it this way? That's a tough thing to find. And certainly my impression of my experience at Brown, they were very good at empowering residents to question why we're doing what we're doing. And that leads to more curiosity and more inquiry, and it keeps the attendings on their toes and the fellows on their toes, and it keeps everyone up to date. And I think that environment is very important to foster in training, whether you're an attending or resident or medical student.
Yeah, and I absolutely just loved, especially the case for standardizing cesarean delivery techniques. When I read it, I essentially sent it around to everyone that I knew, because I think everyone really relates to, especially the line where you mention, you know, a resident comes to you and asks, what are your preferences? But instead shifting that thought process of, wait, not what are my preferences, what is actually the evidence behind what we do, and why are we doing whatever technique that we're doing. So can you talk a little bit about kind of what sparked your interest in that? How did you come up with even, you know, thinking to write a paper on that?
Well, I think a previous paper that we did was just kind of an updated systematic review of cesarean. And that was at the time, like 7 years ago. I think it was published in like 2013 or something. And we were kind of getting down the road, and we were kind of just looking at the number of additional randomized trials since that time, and it had just exploded. And so we figured it was time for another update. And so as we were working through it, it just seemed like so much information. And I remember talking to a few of the co-authors saying, like, isn't there just a better way to approach this than just another systematic review with another two-page table that is not going to change practice? And so that kind of shifted our focus to maybe doing more of an editorial kind of commentary type of a paper. And so this was the result. And it, I'm sure the editors of the Green Journal were kind of scratching their head at where do we place this? But I certainly appreciative of the publication, and that's to their credit too.
Yeah, that was a fun paper. I was the handling editor for that journal, because of course Dwight was on the paper and was conflicted out of participating in the review process. And I just want to sort of do a tangential thing here regarding publications and conflicts of interest. It gets very dicey when you've got a small community of people who are writing and doing research, because you all know each other, and trying to do a review of something that there's potential conflicts on are really important. So if you're an author or a reviewer or an editor, it's really important to be aware of those and identify them and try to keep yourself from being yanked in one way or the other, positively or negative. You can have a positive conflict as well as a negative one. But that was that paper was really fun to manage through the process. I wanted to ask a question that the two of you have done together, or largely overlapping, at least four papers that I could find that are reviews of guidelines, postpartum hemorrhage, standardizing C-section technique, cholestasis, and RH alaminization are the four that I could find. There's maybe more in there, but you, either of your names show up on those four. And I'm really interested in why you're looking at these. What's your goal of looking at them? It seems like the conclusions of each of these is there are these three or four organizations, ACOG, RCOG, SGOC, and RANSCOG, that you routinely look at. And the conclusions are frequently, there's a lot of variation in what these organizations look at, what guidelines, you know, how the guidelines come about. And I could see that you might be on a crusade to say guidelines are not well done, we shouldn't pay attention to them. Or the conclusion might be we need more research to inform guidelines. Or your goal might be, hey, there's this variation out here, pick one and go with it, and then standardize practice. So I could see lots of different reasons for doing what you're doing. But I don't want to assume I'm in your head. So tell us why you do this work.
I don't want to speak for Jeff, but I would say our goal would be for standardization as much as possible. What's interesting to me is postpartum hemorrhage, from what I'm aware of, doesn't change whether you're in the United States or Great Britain or Canada or New Zealand. But yet the guidelines are quite different, both in the data that they extract and make the guidelines from, and just the everything as simple as it is just the definition of things. Like, we can't even agree on a definition. And so that to me is the, I think, the overriding picture of the goal of highlighting these differences is the disease processes that we are talking about are no different in different countries. And so can we join forces and unite and agree on at least, you know, very basic things like definition that I think overall would benefit clinicians for sure and downstream to the patients.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's this premise called like a Delphi consensus where you agree on what, you know, at least a variety of factors, the definition, the evaluation and management, what matters to both clinicians, but also to patients. Oh no.
You all right?
Yeah, my computer just logged off. That's so weird. You're still there. Okay, good. But I think I think there's a variety of reasons why it's beneficial. One, we can't, if we have variable, the same trial that has different inclusion criteria for a given clinical condition, it's very difficult to extrapolate what to do with that. So in this week's issue of the Gray Journal, there's an editorial from people from ISUOG complaining about the SMFM FGR guidelines. And how do we kind of put these two guidelines together when a trial could be done in the UK on the management of fetal growth restriction, and we're not going to have the same approach to it. Right. Granted, we have different patient populations in the United States and different demographics, but I think the more that we have heterogeneity in guidelines, the more that it actually affects patients' experiences and outcomes. I also think, like, from a research perspective, those gaps in care are areas where there's clinical questions that can be asked. But from like a clinical perspective, if you know what's available in the literature, it really empowers you to know that where there are different approaches to a different clinical situation and where what trials are out there. So when guidelines are made, they're often selective and they're biased from the people that are writing it, and they decide if they want to include a paper or not. And so I think the more that you read these other guidelines, you can realize what other international experts are thinking and how they're going through problems. As a good example, there's one that recently came out from Canada on the prevention of preterm birth. And like in America, we think we've got this down pat. You know, it's all McKenna, $1,000 a shot. This is the only way to prevent preterm birth. And I think that's just incredibly hubris and probably narrow-minded for a condition that we don't even know what the etiology is.
And we do so well with it.
Yeah. So I think it's a really great space for preterm birth to like look at what's happening elsewhere and figure out, are there different ways that we can approach this? I think it's also doable. So that's like the elephant in the room, is that this is a paper that you can write as a fellow or resident. One thing that I experienced, and Josh was alongside me during this, was we were working on a project on the prevention and management of obstetric anal sphincter injuries when I was in fellow with actually Nicole Teal, who's at UNC.
Oh, yeah.
And we had the entire thing written, like ready to submit. And I have this RSS feed, like a, you know, articles pushed to me every day that I review and put on Twitter. And I saw a review on that article in, I forgot what journal it was. And it was like, I was so crushed. So just to keep in mind that if you're working on these papers, that it's not, it's very easy to get scooped. And so to choose something that you think is unique and maybe a different perspective other than just like literally making a table and putting them together.
Well, I do want to highlight a couple of things that you both have touched upon. You know, I love the idea of knowing where to get the information. You know, sometimes you are in residency and it's really busy and you don't really know, or maybe you're in attending and you just don't really know where you can look for that information. And I love the idea of starting at guidelines, but not necessarily from the US, as a way to see, okay, what is happening in other parts of the world? And what is, you know, what are the studies that may not have been included in, you know, ACOG or SMFM, to just kind of get a more robust view of all the things. So I love that. And then can you tell us a little bit more about ways to make it easier to get the information? So you said an RSS feed, you know, what are some other things that have helped you both kind of stay up to date or stay current as, you know, busy practitioners currently in practice?
I'll give a shout out to guidelines in this way. I think it's a great start. I think, you know, as you build your knowledge base, when a guideline is updated, I think it's valuable to go back to the previous guideline and see what's changed, what additional data they've used to maybe change recommendations, and then explore the references and make a determination whether or not those things are warranted. So I would give a shout out to start there, especially for residents. I still do it today as an attending. And so I think, especially when updates occur to practice bulletins or SMFM expert series, those are wonderful resources. If nothing else, it's a resource of references for you to go back to when you have more time.
Yeah, when you look at the evidence-based triangle or pyramid, depending on how it's drawn, right? But the guidelines are always at the top. And I think one of the things your research has highlighted is, yes, those are really valuable, but you also have to be a critical thinker about what's in those guidelines. And so I think that work has been super important in that regard. But Jeff, what about you? Where do you go for
So when I was in residency, Dwight Rouse told me I had to read 14 journals every month and gave me a list of the 14 journals. I diligently wrote them all down. And then at some point in fellowship, I discovered this like this PubMed RSS feed where you can, you know, choose articles from, you know, the authors you want and the journals you want, and it gets pushed to you. So every day I get a list of all the articles that have come out in basically obstetrics, mostly obstetrics and gynecology. And I sift through them and then post them on Twitter if they seem like they're of any interest. But there's other mechanisms of doing that. You can do it through Google Scholar, and you can do it through QXMD. So I think that's good. And then I have like on Twitter, this little like channel that's Academic OBGYN, and it's like all of the articles, and it gets sent to me every, you know, and I go through that. I try to only have an academic Twitter page because otherwise it gets me in trouble. So, but that's how I try to keep up with it. And I'm a big fan of like repetition is the mother of all learning, of all learning, of all learning. So I kind of feel like the more times you go back to these things, the better you get at it. And, you know, we have now it's easier with clouds to save articles and keep them for reference in the future and just like organizing your, you know, all of your the articles you've read. I think another thing that can be helpful is, you know, journal clubs, even if it's like small groups. You don't need to be a statistical master to get through these. It's just about talking about articles and thinking through them as a group. And I think that's a really fun way to do it over a cup of coffee and a pastry. And even if you haven't read it, you should still show up because you can still learn something, especially. So we did a lot of reading in residency. We read an article basically every single day. It was didn't matter what rotation you were on. You were expected to have read an article and showed up the next day to talk about it. So I thought that was really helpful, and it kind of just engaged me and reading stuff constantly. So yeah. that's where I get information. I think the more that you can, you know, like get ideas from other specialties too to bring into OBGYN, the better off you'll be. And I think there's a lot of really creative approaches to both research techniques, but also ideas and other specialties that we can apply to women's health.
Yeah, and I think that our last episode, we were talking about the enhanced recovery after surgery, which was basically started from a lot of the colorectal evidence. So I think that your point is well taken. You know, we can learn a lot from other specialties.
As physicians, we all know it's important to stay on top of the latest research and guidelines. That's why we created OBG First's Guideline Notifications, mobile-friendly daily notifications of guideline changes and research summaries. Make staying informed of new announcements and releases easier, all for the cost of a cup of coffee. We've got a special offer just for our listeners for 2 months free off their OBG First subscription. Go to obgproject.com/getfirst and use promo code OBGSpotify at checkout. That's obgproject.com/getfirst, promo code OBGSpotify.
Well, you know, I don't want to keep you all too long, and I know that at least two of us have to go to labor and delivery quite soon.
I'm going to my Peloton bike. So
two to labor and delivery, one to Peloton.
That sounds like it should be on the podcast.
Yeah. All of it is going to get our hearts pumping one way or another.
Yeah, absolutely.
So fair enough. But I think that my final question then, and then Nancy, if you have any other questions to finish us off, is that did either of the guidelines, either the standardization of cesarean delivery or the postpartum hemorrhage, did it change your practice?
I would say the standardization one did. I was very adamant with two-layer closure and got shot down to put one-layer closure, probably the most controversial step. And so now I close with one layer, and it's thrown off all the residents that's worked with me in the past. But I think we can be flexible, and when data comes out to suggest that we should change practice, it's really, really hard to change something that is habitual. And so I wouldn't call it humility, but just the ability to kind of question and re-question what you're doing every day, I think is super valuable and moves the needle forward. And so if anything, I think that paper certainly did cause some tweaks in my cesarean technique to become congruent with what we put out.
Yeah, so it's a robust discussion, one layer versus two layer at our hospital as well.
I'm sure it is, yeah.
I think the actual technique didn't change as much for me because I had already kind of adopted a lot of those things from our conversation. What I was surprised at was like how the conversation about standardization was a challenge. And that was like a real learning process for me. It was like, how do you engage people to change as adults, both and physicians, I think. And I'm still trying to figure that one out. Like, I can't quite figure out how do you engage people to change, and how do you get teach an old dog new tricks? And that's been way more challenging than actually changing one layer versus two layer for just myself, is how do you engage people who are doing the thousands and thousands of C-sections around the country to buy into something like this? And that is the million-dollar question, because I think until we do that, we're this is like almost like an academic exercise of discussing this. So I think the more that we can standardize things, I think that's how we'll probably achieve equity in healthcare delivery in the United States, is where we can really say, this is the standard. You can deviate from that with a rationale, but ideally this is the bare minimum that everybody gets.
Yeah, and that's actually the follow-up question that I was gonna have, and Ashley and I are working on a side project that really addresses this issue of, if you're gonna deliver value in healthcare, including equity within that as a major piece of it, is how do you motivate physicians and other clinicians, and honestly, hospital administrators and nurses, to standardize practice? And you figure 80% of people will be covered by a standard practice, 20% will be outliers and won't fit, right? But for that 80%, and I'm picking that because of the 80-20 rule, but it generally applies. For that 80%, how do you motivate people to adopt best practice? And that's a whole other podcast and a whole other line of thinking that a lot of people are thinking about. But I think that your work has the potential to inform that, because it lays out what the guidelines are and where their gaps are, but it does bring it to light, you know, that there are guidelines out here on these things, and why the heck aren't we doing it? So I really do share your wish, Jeff, that there would be a way of motivating people that would be a positive motivation, not a negative one, to improve practice. So that ends up being a diatribe, not a question. Sorry.
Well, I mean, I think I do think that as clinicians and as residents, a lot of what motivates people is feeling valued. And and when you feel like you're a valued member of the team, the healthcare organization, and the relationship is reciprocal, same thing as a patient. Like, if you feel like your doctor is listening to you and hears you, and it's a true relationship, I think it just makes it a much more positive experience where you're willing to change. And when that's not the case, when there's no relationship there, or it's a one-way street, then I think there's not a lot of motivation to change.
I just, real quick, I think at least with the standardized C-section paper, it's written for clinicians who are in practice and have been doing it for 20 years. But the more I think about it, I really believe that it's written for trainees and those who are teaching trainees. So in order for things to change, it's probably not going to be the bald gray haired people like me. It's going to come from the residents who are the next generation. And so I'd encourage that perspective a little bit too. It changes slow, but the trainees currently and those that are to follow are the ones that can really make the biggest impact.
Well stated, I agree.
Yeah, well, on that note, I don't think that I could add anything more to that other than robustly agreeing with everything you have all said. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This is fun.
Thanks for having us. I really appreciate it.